Oh, Brad, what have you done now?
You're talking to the Rolex wearing. Woo! Diamond ring wearing. Woo! Kiss stealing. Woo! Wheeling, dealing. Woo! Limousine riding. Woo! Jet flying. Woo! Suck it up, look up. Woo! And I'm having a hard time. Holy Alligator Bound. Now give me two claps and a Ric Flair.
This is the Brad Gilmore Show on demand. On demand.
What's going on, y'all? This is DJ DMD, and y'all are checking out the Brad Gilmore Show on demand right here.
What's going down? It's your homie Dope Easy, the Southeast Beast, and make sure you tune in to the Brad Gilmore Show.
Five-time WCW champion, and you're listening to the Brad Gilmore Show. Can you dig that, sucker?
On demand.
On demand.
On demand.
And now, here's your host, Brad Gilmore. Gilmore.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Brad Gilmore Show. On demand. It's been a while, hasn't it? The last time we checked in, it was like Drake and Meek Mill were still beefing. You know, back to back was still firing hard in the clubs. Do you know what I mean? Firing hard in the clubs. That's what I said, and I meant it. Welcome back to the show. We've taken a short hiatus, but we're about to be back with some great new interviews, some great new guests. Not even new guests, some old guests. Why is that such a hard word to say? Guests. I don't know. Literally, I'm doing this with a headset on for the first time, I'm actually thinking, and I'm listening to myself say guests, guests. Guests. I don't know why it sounds... Does it sound as strange to you as it does to me? I think I'm losing my mind. Anyway, today I thought we'd do something really interesting. Right now, I'm in season 2 of my Back to the Future podcast, where we look back in time at the greatest film trilogy of all time, Back to the Future. And what we're doing now is we're in the middle of season 2 talking about Back to the Future Part 2. And I have new co-hosts, David Mitchell and Norman Binford, as I like to call Davey Boy Mitch and Normie Norm. And we're looking at Back to the Future Part 2 and all the characters, the behind-the-scenes information on it. So what I thought I'd do here for a couple weeks on the Brad Gilmore Show on demand. Oh, look at that. My phone's going off. That's actually – every time I do a Brad Gilmore Show intro, my phone goes off. Anyway, what I thought we'd do here is actually play some of the interviews, not so much the behind-the-scenes stuff, but the interviews that I conducted for Back to the Future, the podcast, Season 1. And the most extensive, the most long-form interview that I did on the podcast was with Jeffrey Weissman, who played George McFly in Back to the Future Part 2 and in Part 3. Now, what's interesting about this man is he replaced Crispin Glover, which is something we get into here. My phone keeps going off. He replaced Crispin Glover when Crispin Glover either was told not to come back or was fired or whatever happened there. It was in contract negotiations, and it just didn't happen. Crispin Glover didn't make the movie, so they wrote a part for Jeffrey Weissman as George McFly. Look, my phone won't stop going off. But Jeffrey Weissman plays the part of George McFly, and we talk about all the things that he's doing. He actually has an upcoming Back to the Future cruise to end Parkinson's, which is something that I'm very interested in that we talk about in this interview. So here's kind of an archived edition of the Brad Gilmore Show on Demand, but it's Jeffrey Weissman on Season 1 of Back to the Future, the podcast, and we're going to talk to him here on the Brad Gilmore Show on Demand. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Brad Gilmore Show on Demand. I have such a great guest on the line with me right now to join me to kick off this Back to the Future retrospective series, which I've been working on for a few weeks now. So excited to get it started. This man, you'll recognize him because he starred as George McFly in Back to the Future Parts 2 and 3. He is Mr. Jeffrey Weissman. How you doing today, sir?
Nice introduction, Brad. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Sounds great. How are you?
I've done this once or twice. I'm doing great. Can't complain. Right off the top of the bat, I actually want to start with something that's near and dear to my heart. It's something that you're doing that I think is a really great cause. You're doing a Back to the Future cruise to end Parkinson's disease. And many of my fans who listen to the show know my grandmother has had Parkinson's disease for the last 10 years. And it's something really near and dear to my heart. So talk to me about why you wanted to do this cruise and a little bit about what it is.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your grandma's condition, and that's part of the reason I'm helping produce this event. I saw my father go through his dementia and Alzheimer's, and his best friend had Parkinson's, as well as one of my best friends has recently been diagnosed with the terminal version of Parkinson's. And then we all know and love Michael J. Fox. So, in essence, because Back to the Future has been really wonderful to me over the years, fans around the world and such, I figured what better way to give back to the fans and to give to Michael than by producing a cruise where everyone can have an intimate kind of, you know, celebratory for the films and intimate gathering with celebrities from the films, and at the same time raise money for the Michael J. Fox Parkinson's Foundation via Team Fox. So we're going to the Caribbean in November of this year.
Wow, all the way to the... See, I've never been on a cruise, so I don't really know what to expect, but I know that you're going to have some Back to the Future-related things going on. There's going to be an Enchantment Under the Sea dance, right?
Yes, I got Harry Waters Jr., who played Marvin Berry, you know, Chuck's cousin, to come on board. We're going to have him lead the band, you know, doing Earth Angel and Night Train, you know, the songs that he got a gold record for, in fact. So he's on board. I'm thinking the band backing him up is going to be composed of members of the cast, myself on guitar, Mark McClure, who played Dave McFly on drums, and Don Fullalove, who played Mayor Goldie Wilson on bass.
Oh, wow. So you got like the Back to the Future band right there.
That's right. That's right. Now, we may go that route. We also, if we sell enough cabins, may hire a little more polished band. I put invites out to Huey Lewis to see if he would come. So I haven't heard, a lot of the pieces of the puzzle haven't been set yet, but right now that's the tentative plan.
Now, when you talk about like the cruise and there's going to be the band playing and all this money, right, it goes to the Michael J. Fox Foundation and Team Fox. It's like an incredible thing. How can people, if they want to help out, get involved with this cause?
Well, the way that people can help out is to come and have fun. Sign up to book your cabin, come on the cruise. I don't want to mislead. From the proceeds, we need to pay back our production costs, and then from that we're splitting with from those proceeds we're going to split with the Michael J. Fox Parkinson's Foundation via our Team Fox project. And another way, people who can't come on the cruise but still want to give, we have a Team Fox page already up, and it's part of the calendar. If you go to the bttfcruise.com or cruisetoendparkinsons.com or Back to the Future Cruise to End Parkinson's, it all takes you to our page. And under links, there's a link page. We have the link to our Team Fox page that people can donate directly to. And that helps support. We would love to make $1 million for the cause. Right now, I think we're up to $800.
Well, hey, every little bit helps, and I definitely really commend you, and I want to thank you on behalf of all family members who may have someone, a loved one who's suffered from Parkinson's disease. Thank you for doing something, and anything I can do to help, I definitely will. But here we are, we have you.
Well, you're doing it. You're just by having me on and getting word out, that's key. If people spread the word, that's going to make this a success. I've also got some really great events on board that will be of interest to yourself and others who have family members or people who are suffering with Parkinson's. I've been meeting with leading research scientists at the Buck Institute, and we're going to Scripps and various other health organizations, hospitals, and universities that are working on finding a cure. And we're going to be doing a workshop on board during the cruise on the advances made towards finding a cure. In fact, I met with a leading research scientist who's been able to remove Parkinson's from these microscopic worms. So in essence, he's been able first to inject the disease into these lab worms, and then he's able to, through the process of replacing these proteins in their makeup, to eviscerate the disease. So it's really kind of exciting to see that there's really progress that is viable, that is being made. And we're going to have hopefully the latest and greatest, if not in-person scientists, will be sharing PowerPoints of their progress. And that's all part of the cruise as well. And then, of course, the cruise line, the ship that we're on is one of the world's largest passenger cruise ships on Royal Caribbean. And it has so many incredible fun things like a zip line and a surf pool and amazing food and service. And we're going from Fort Lauderdale to a private island and then to Jamaica and to Cozumel and back for 7 days and eight days and seven nights.
Wow, that sounds like an incredible... You know what? I might just have to book my ticket. I got to tell the girlfriend, let's go on this cruise, because I'm really interested about this Parkinson's research, and if there was any year to help finally find this cure to Parkinson's, I would think 2015 would be a pretty apropos year. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah. Yes, with all the advances and all the expectations, of course, the hopes that everyone has for seeing the hoverboard and flying cars and everything... Looking at the scientific advances, this would be the year to really see some breakthroughs.
I definitely agree with you. Well, once again, go to backtothefuturecruise.com and BTTFcruise.com and find out how you can get involved. Book your ticket. If you can't, donate something, become a sponsor. We're going to figure out a way to beat this thing and to make sure this cruise is a huge success. Jeffrey, though, I got to talk to you. I got to start off. We're talking about,
if you look at it, it's maybe about $200 a day to be on this cruise. It's not really that bad of a deal, and you're also going to be with at least 8, if not 10, of the celebrities from the Back to the Future movies in an intimate environment where you get to sort of kick around, see all the do the behind the scenes conversations and all the fun stuff. You know, it's pretty exclusive to this cruise, and we also just found out that the Star Trek Convention at Sea is going to be on the same boat, and they've offered free admission to all their events to our guests.
Oh, wow. So if you're a Trekkie and you love Back to the Future, this might just be a match made in heaven for you. It's pretty
a win-win.
Much, yeah, it's a win-win. when we talk about Back to the Future, the series has always been my favorite film trilogy of all time. When I was a kid, I always loved Back to the Future 3. And then, you know, I grew to love Back to the Future 1. I thought that was my favorite.
How many times have you watched the trilogy?
How many times? Oh, I can't even imagine how many times. I almost know it word for word. It's funny, and this is actually a line of yours in the film. Not too long ago, I went golfing with my boss, and I actually pulled a muscle in my back. And when I went home that evening, my girlfriend was like, what's wrong with your back? And I'm like, oh, I hurt it out on the golf course again, you know. And she probably had no idea what I was talking about, but it was direct reference to a line of yours in the Back to the Future trilogy. I've seen it, you know, dozens and dozens of times.
As we got to string you up in the ortholev.
Yeah, I know. I needed the ortholev. I needed to straighten up that back. It's terrible.
I read today there's a guy named Matthew Harrison in England who's also putting on a Parkinson's fundraiser that right away. It's not in the distance, but it's coming up pretty soon. And he, the BBC and the Mirror over in England did an article on him. He claims to have watched the series 1,700 times, I think.
Well, I don't have him beat on that one. I don't have him beat on that one.
You might find him on Facebook, Matthew Harrison. He posts on BTTF.com Facebook page. And anyway, I just read that today. He's got like 1,300 views of the trilogy. And I think part two, his favorite, is the one that he's watched over 600 times, something like this.
Jeez.
They're like, holy moly.
I don't know how he found all the time to do that. But I've definitely seen it dozens and dozens of times. Definitely one of my favorite trilogies. No, my favorite trilogy of all time. And you had the privilege, I guess, to be in two of these films playing George McFly. First off, I just want to get your first thoughts. When Back to the Future came out in 1985, what were your thoughts when you first... Did you see the movie when it came out in theaters?
Yeah, of course. I saw it becoming attraction, and I said, I got to see this. And I went, saw it, I think, the first week it opened. And I had, about a year and a half before it came out, done a film at AFI, the American Film Institute, with Crispin Glover. And I didn't know Crispin was in the first film. And when I saw his work, I was like, hey, I know that guy. He's great. He's so freaking quirky. And and wonderful. And so I was kind of proud, first of all, that I knew this guy, I'd worked with him. And I love Michael J. Fox's work and Chris Lloyd's work from television and a film and such. So it was a thrill. It was really a wonderful ride. It was a great film. And so I, in fact, I had Crispin's number. I went home and I called him just to commend him on his work. Little did I know that 4 years later I'd be asked to first be his photo double and then ironically take over the role.
Yeah, I mean,
when he didn't work out his contract.
That's an incredible thing, and I definitely want to get to that. But when I saw that first movie too, it was I didn't get the opportunity to see it in theaters, as to where I was not alive yet. But the first chance I did get to see Back to the Future, I absolutely fell in love with it. And when you talk about Christopher Lloyd, whom is one of my favorite actors of all time, you talk about Clue the movie, The Addams Family, The Pagemaster, Back to the Future, and all the other things he's been in. I mean, he really brought, to me, when I first saw Back to the Future, I love Michael J. Fox, but to me, the star of the show for that first movie was Christopher Lloyd and his portrayal of Dr. Emmett L. Brown. I mean, what an incredible job he did.
He really was magnificent. He really brought such quirky, fun playfulness to his characterization. It's ironic to think that he actually threw the script away when he first got it.
I know. I heard you talk about that on another show. I mean, that's incredible. And I know people. Doc Brown even says in Back to the Future 2, he's going to try to figure out the question everyone wants to know, women, right? He wants to know about women. But I'll tell you why you keep women around, because they make sure you're in Back to the Future and they take that script out of the trash can.
Yeah, that's right. Chris owes a little bit to that girlfriend of his that did that. Otherwise, it would have been, I think they wanted John Lithgow, and I think John was going to take some time off. So he passed on it, but then they were in talks maybe with Jeff Goldblum to play Doc Brown.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Jeff Goldblum, very talented guy, could not do what Christopher Lloyd did. It would have been a completely different movie. A completely different movie.
Oh, yeah. Jeff Goldblum and Eric Stoltz. That would have been interesting.
Back to the Future 4. anyway, but so you loved the movie when you saw it, and then it came out in 85, and then the sequels came out around 89, and you talked about Crispin Glover, whom you worked with, which I found interesting, and congratulated on his work in the film. He could not come to terms with his contract to return for the sequels. So let me ask you this. How did you get involved? How did you go from congratulating this man on a job well done to inevitably taking over the role? How did you get involved with the whole Back to the Future franchise?
I had, the same year that the first film came out, I co-starred in a film with Clint Eastwood called Pale Rider, and I had been doing film and television for a number of years. In about 88-89, I had been working in between film and TV work at Universal Studios in Hollywood playing characters on the tour. I was their number one. Stan Laurel of Laurel and Hardy played Charlie Chaplin and Groucho Marx up there. And the guy who helped me get that work up there, a lookalike agent, called me up at my dressing room and asked if I knew who Crispin was. And I said, of course, you know, I'd worked with him. He asked if I was the same height or so. And I said, no, he's a little taller than me and maybe a little heavier. But what was up? And he let me know that they were looking for a stand-in photo double for him. And I said, oh, for the Back to the Future sequel. He said, no, I'm not at liberty to tell you. I said, get me in there. You know, I can use the work. My wife at the time was pregnant with our second child, and I needed to qualify for my medical benefits, and I needed the work. So I met with the assistant directors. They liked my resume and my demeanor, and next I went to casting, and they approved of my work. And then next I went to makeup to be fitted for prosthetics and body cast for special effects. I never was I told really during that process that I was really up for the role. Rather, it was to be a photo double. And I knew that Michael was going to need photo doubles for playing multiple characters. They would need someone to stand in basically for him as Marty Jr. or Marlene while he's being Marty and vice versa. And so I figured they needed to have George, multiple Georges in various scenes. That's, you know, what occurred to me. And it was really not until the 11th hour that I found out from my agent that they wanted me as George. The makeup artist alluded to that Crispin might be out, that I was going to be George. And at that point, I was like, I can't fathom that. How can they make this film without Crispin? It seems impossible. And because Crispin and Bob Gill and company, Spielberg, they just would not agree to his terms. He put on demands that I don't even think Michael J. Fox put on, of script approval and so on and so forth. They just couldn't work it out with him. Apparently he wouldn't budge much. So they decided they would get around him by using the makeup effects on me. Which, of course, they didn't get away with because Crispin ended up suing. And they finally settled out of court. And, you know, the rest is history, that SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, laid down a rule that producers cannot make an actor look like another actor without his permission. After Part 3 came out, Crispin actually called me and expressed his how upset he was that they used his likeness on me without his permission, and that they were going to pay him very minimal amount. And I saw the injustice in that. And I agreed that he was handed an unfair bill of goods. But then again, I was sucked into this mess and caught in the middle. And it was not a pleasant place to be, except in the long run, you know, being a part of the great series of films and also to have met these fans now for 25 years from around the world who just love these films, and to celebrate the films with them has been a big benefit for me.
I mean, it's incredible how worldwide this trilogy is and how it resonates with so many people. In your opinion, why do you think Back to the Future resonates with a large majority of the Earth's population, it would seem? Why do you think that we love these movies?
Oh, because they're so wonderfully made and so playful, and also deal with so many things that people fantasize about, going back and meeting your parents as teenagers, or going back and seeing if you can, you know, change time or experience another time period. The whole time travel thing, the whole relationship, the relationship between Doc Brown and Marty is amazingly wonderful and tender. And it's rare that you find a story where you can have an older man and a young man have a very close friendship and tenderness between each other without it being referred to derogatorily. Does that make sense?
Derogatorily, I think that's a word. I think you can get away with that one. No one's going to call you on it.
The last time two men, say, had a close relationship like that, Laurel and Hardy, they could sleep in the same bed with each other, and, you know, no one would think twice about it, you know, that there would be anything sexual between them. You know, there was this incredible closeness between Doc and Marty, like they were family or best of friends, and you rarely see that between an older man and a young man. And that's a lovely point of that film. And also, the storytelling is tight. The creativeness is just magnificent. The talent involved in those films, just fantastic. That was probably the other incredible part for me, is to be in the realm of Robert Zemeckis and his wonderful crew. And then, of course, the incredibly talented cast. That it was like walking into, I felt like I was a stepchild or an adopted kid walking into this family.
We, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Back to the Future movies. I've studied them, of course, and, you know, I work on a TV show here in Houston, and sometimes I help write out the TV show and plan it out. And one of the biggest things that I find as a challenge is the logistics of keeping a tight continuity. And for me, when I think about having to be in Bob Gale's position and going and Bob Zemeckis' position of going back to the first movie in the second movie, and the logistical nightmare that must have been for you, being a part of the cast and on set for that, because you sent me some wonderful photos, and one is the iconic scene of Biff, you know, twisting the arm of George McFly when he's trying to defend Lorraine. How big of a logistical nightmare was it from an actor's standpoint to shoot that movie, especially Back to the Future 2, when you go back into Back to the Future 1?
Well, it's interesting. I during the shooting, asked Robert Zemeckis, because I was a huge fan of Who Framed Roger Rabbit that he directed, are you going to do a sequel of that? And he said, nah, I don't know. I don't think so. And I was so disappointed. I said, why was it? Because it was so complicated shooting animation with live action. And he said, no, I've got much more complicated shots on this film than I did on that. So, yes, to support your thought, it was very complicated, especially with the special effects in the future with the flying cars and the multiple actors playing multiple roles simultaneously. So there were very complicated shots and effects. In fact, my hours in the McFly household of the future, those days were extremely long. It took 4 hours just to get the makeup on often. So my call would be 4:30 in the morning to be ready to shoot on set by 8:30 or 9 o'clock. And then we would shoot for 20 hours. Maybe, you know, some of my days were 20, 21, 22, and 26 hours long. When we went back to recreate the shots from part one, the Enchantment Under the Sea dance and the fight out in the high school parking lot, those were fairly simple, in at least for me, because we had the reference of the first film. I could run the playback and see the exact positioning of the arm, the height, the swing, the dance moves, whatever that we needed to do. Whereas, and of course it was complicated, you know, having different angles and then Marty, say, up in the rafters or up on the catwalk above the stage. That's not the catwalk. I guess it is. Anyway, those were complicated, but it was the stuff in the future that seemed to be more complicated. We had, right and left these special effects going on, while, say, behind the set, there's a team of ladies making pizzas so they come out fresh for every take. It was, pretty hungry making, smelling pizza all day during that kitchen scene in the McFly kitchen of 2015. The effects of, example, the projection on the window of a placid scene, and Lorraine goes over and pulls the shade up and it's a brick wall. We had terrible complications just to get that right, because you often could see the flickering of the slide projector that was projecting the scene when she pulled the shade. And it took Zemeckis quite a few hours to figure out how to get over that. And that was the beauty of watching Zemeckis' work. He really was a problem solver. And any great director should take note that what he does basically is casts very capable talent and sort of sits back and waits for problems to arise and then solves them.
You know, when you talk about that scene, the scene in the future when they're all sitting at the dinner table and Marty, Michael J. Fox is playing Marty McFly Sr., Jr., and his daughter. And then, there's
Marlene.
And then there's a scene with you and Lorraine. And you're on the ortholev. First of all, let's talk about the ortholev. What is actually the purpose? Let me ask you this. Was the purpose of you hanging upside down to sort of disorientate the viewer from trying to figure out, is that Crispin Glover or not? Or was there a logical reasoning for you being upside down?
Yeah, it's like an inversion table. Have you ever seen an inversion table?
Yeah.
To help someone straighten out their spine. Well, that was the concept. George got hit while golfing on the golf course by a car that had fallen out of the sky. so they had George in this ortholev. Now, while we were shooting, someone on the crew alluded that this was meant for Crispin, to torture Crispin. And I was like, okay, well, that kind of makes sense, because he was apparently a pain in the ass on the first film. Mm-hmm. Making demands, and they probably want to pay back, but I ended up enduring the torture, and but that's beside the fact. In the as part of the story, it was the ortholev, which was beautifully designed by Industrial Light and Magic. They had these tracks running from the front door, outside the front door, all the way through the set to the kitchen set, and then Unfortunately, this ended up on the cutting room floor, but I finally got to rotate my access for pizza for dinner. And I think there's some of that deleted scene called pizza in the bonus material. I'm not sure if it's on the Blu-ray or not. I haven't taken a look at that, but it's on the initial DVD release.
I think it is on the Blu-ray. I think I've seen this scene on the Blu-ray. Yeah.
Well, then you get to see George finally rotate his axis. And that's where I wore the body cast underneath my costume, because outside of the, or coming from the body cast, going through the set, was a pole that went through the set. And on the end of that pole was a wheel that a Teamster turned on cue to help me rotate. And I did my little golf swing, and George laughed. Four! So the effects were, like I said, very complicated and time-consuming. I remember being spun upside down once, and I didn't catch my breath, and I had been locked into this body cast. And so I had no breath, and Zemeckis had called action, and I couldn't breathe, and I had a claustrophobic moment. I was actually literally trying to rip the costume off, trying to get out of this, and Zemeckis had to say, cut, what? Jeffrey, what's wrong? And it was because I couldn't breathe. I hadn't caught a good breath, and the body cast was kind of tight.
Well, that would be a good reason to stop production if you can't breathe. I would think that's a good excuse as an actor. I can't breathe.
And I said, you got to give me a minute. I got to walk this off. And I put myself back together and got back in it to do the take. But, you know, it was really a joy, really, to work on that set, because, once again, if you looked closely, it was art directed within an inch of its life. There were so many incredible little details that were art directed on that set that never made it to screen. I just saw a photo finally of my whole costume standing upright. They made this beautiful jacket. You could see my watch, George McFly's watch in one shot, and all these things that never made it to the screen. They were just prepared. And of course, that's how they really want it. They want to be prepared for anything that might come up in rehearsals or that the director wants to shoot. And of course, they must have had a great budget for that art department.
Well, you know, think about it, because nowadays we live in a world where the film franchises are all universe building. You know, they all, you know, build these universes with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, DC Cinematic Universe. And I think back in the 80s with the Back to the Future series, they did an amazing job at building a universe for these Back to the Future films. When you see the Hill Valley in the 50s, the 80s, and this year, the current year, 2015, it is really amazing. And I think that was like the best way to show a passage of time, was when you look at like the Texaco in 55 to the Texaco in 2015 and stuff like that. I mean, it was incredibly built, and I think that those future world was probably the most intensely art directed shots of the entire movie. And then you think about,
and they also were able to show such great levity, so much good comedy, because when you enter 55 and they pass the Texaco station, all of a sudden there's all these attendants as soon as someone pulls in, wiping the windshield and checking the oil and pumping the gas, whereas in 2015, it's a robot coming out to do it.
Yeah, you know, if only we were there now. Now, let me ask you this. In 2015, here we are. A lot of things, some things from Back to the Future came true. Some did not. Obviously, we have no flying cars. But what was one of your favorite gadgets, your favorite future gadgets from the movie Back to the Future 2?
Brad, I can call you Babe, can I?
You can call me Babe.
Enough.
That's fine. I feel like we have close
Brad,
enough.
Babe. The year is young.
True. We're only in April.
We do have the multiple channel possibilities on your TV. We have Skype. Those things came true. They now have a hoverboard that works at least with a metal surface. Those guys down in Silicon Valley.
I've seen that, yeah.
You know, it's the year is young. We haven't seen if the Cubs and the Marlins are going to go to the World Series yet.
Now, I'm putting money on the Cubbies. I will say that. But what was your favorite scene? I mean, what was your favorite gadget from the future? Was it the hoverboard? Was it the pizza hydrator, which is a favorite of mine? What was your favorite future gadget?
Oh, Let's see. Well, of course, the hoverboard is just awesome.
Yeah, incredible.
Especially the Bulldog. But I'm blanking on the name of it. Wouldn't you know? What is it that Doc can put the beer can in the
Mr. Fusion.
Banana peel in? Mr. Fusion. Jeez, come on, Mr. Fusion, of course. I think that's the best.
No, yeah, that's pretty cool, too. I mean, and just the way everyone was, like, I love Back to the Future 2. Like I said, my original favorite was 3, then I really love 1, but now Back to the Future 2 is my favorite of the series, just based upon that future scene. And it's funny, because I think about it as the future movie, even though we're not in the future that long in the film.
No.
It takes mostly place in the past, and, you know, the alternate 1985. We talked about 2, and I know 3 had limited scenes of George McFly. But talk about Back to the Future 3, going back to a Western. When you found out go ahead.
Originally, Part 2 and Part 3 were one script under the name Paradox. And they figured by stretching out the stories, they could make it into 2 films and probably double their money, which they did. The part of Seamus McFly originally was to be played by Crispin.
Oh, wow.
So as if Michael didn't have enough work already, they put him in the role when Crispin didn't return, because it really wouldn't work if I came in. No one really knew my face from Adam in the series, or from the first film. But I loved it personally. I had in 85 co-starred in a Western with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Called Pale Rider. And I love the Western genre. In fact, I'm currently trying to develop a Western, and to have it, you know, Marty go back to the old West, that just was a treat. You know, first of all, it's going to be celebrating the genre in film. And then the fantasy continues, you know, with time travel. So I remember Bob Gale during the shooting Part 2, old George hanging upside down and all, came up to me and said, you know, we'll find you something in Part 3, you know, without all the makeup, so you can, you know, get your teeth into some role with, you know. And so I went through the script, and I actually came to him. I said, you know, I would like if possible, the Western Union guy who delivers the telegram from the Old West that we've been waiting. We have a bet in the office, you know, that Joe Flaherty ended up playing. And he said, yeah, I think we already have that cast. So I went back to the script trying to find a cowboy thing. And unfortunately, it didn't pan out. That promise, unfortunately, didn't get fulfilled. But, you know, seeing the Indians chasing the DeLorean and the, you know, coming right out of the drive-in theater and the whole essence there, capturing the Old West in the saloon with all those great Harry Carey Jr. and Pat Buttram and all the great Old West character actors in there. Just it was thrilling. It's, if you're a film buff, it was just candy. It was like being in a candy store.
I'm sure you actually probably also got a kick out of Marty's name being Clint Eastwood back in 1885. I'm sure that would probably hit home from you after doing the film with him.
Yeah, it was a giggle.
It was a nice little poke in the ribs.
Yes, of course.
When I think of, though, Back to the Future and the incredible job that Bob Gale did writing these movies, I almost think about it as screenwriting 101, because every line of dialogue paid off in that first and second and third movie. Everything paid off so well. But the one thing that wasn't explained, and it was something that you almost touched on a second ago, was the friendship between Doc and Marty. We're never really fully aware of why these two are friends. And I've been asking everybody who I've done this retrospective with, why do you think Doc and Marty were friends? Where did that relationship stem from in your mind?
Okay, well, let me back up first and remind you that not only Bob Gale, but Bob Zemeckis, you know, co-wrote, and them as a writing team, it's so awesome that equation of them would come up with such great scripts. And yes, how they became friends, you got me. I'm not sure how they became friends, but how cool it is to have a mentor who has this lab that you can go hang and play his guitar with the world's largest amp and speaker. It's adolescent fantasy. It's great stuff.
That was actually my idea. I'm like, maybe they were just friends because Doc had a huge amp for Marty to play with the world's smallest guitar for some reason. That was like the tiniest guitar I've ever seen. But anyway, so we're talking about this. It was small, wasn't it? Wouldn't it seem like a small, petite guitar?
I'll agree, sure.
I didn't know if that was in vogue with the 80s or not. But, you know, Back to the Future was on kind of the cusp of a lot of these trends. You know, you talk about skateboarding. It got really big around that time. And you're shooting two movies at once. You're in the past. You went to the future. You're in the alternate 1985. If they ever did a fourth film, which I know they won't, and I don't even want to see a fourth movie, but if they did a fourth film, where would you like to see them take it? What time period would we like to see in a fourth Back to the Future film?
Well, I have a long history of doing reenactments and period fairs, like Renaissance fairs and Charles Dickens Christmas fairs in Victorian England. So I would love to go to those periods myself. I adore the Dickensian stories, and I have had a huge amount of fun role-playing at Renaissance fairs. So for me, and in fact, I was very close to screen testing for Richard Donner on Lady Hawk. I was on my way to Warner Brothers to my screen test when Matthew Broderick came down in his price. So, and I was going to rock that. I totally wanted to do that. And that was more medieval than Renaissance. But those periods would be a blast. If you could do a part four, it would be great to go to those time periods and capitalize as was it Time After Time did with the Malcolm McDowell, was it the chasing with Jack the Ripper? Was that, am I confusing?
No, I think you're right. I think you're right right there. I think it's Time After Time.
David Warner. Doing Renaissance and Victorian times, I think, would be my choices.
Now, do you think, though, because it's such a beloved film series, but we live in kind of a day and age in film to where nothing is really sacred. Do you think they would ever remake the Back to the Future film series?
You know, there's always going to be that possibility. First of all, the studios want to make money. And yeah. I'm sure the artists, they originally said there would never be a sequel to the first film. And studios just threw enough money at them that they finally all said, okay, let's go back to the bank. And they did. And luckily, the quality and integrity of the artistic team pretty much made great sequels that paid off. The studios, you know, eventually may try to do a remake. I know that Radcliffe, you know, the young man who played Harry Potter would have loved to have played Marty in a remake. He said that in the press once, and other actors have expressed interest. And of course it's been kicked around, and there have been fans and others who have written a part four, you know, but basically you got to go back to the source of Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis. And they say, no, the story is complete. It's done. We don't want to do any more sequel or remake. And it's something that, yeah, I just have to quote them on. And also, I hope that these films never lose their popularity and need to be remade, because they stand up fine. They aren't dated terribly.
I don't really think they're dated. I mean, well, it's funny we talk about dated when they're in time travel movies. But they're not really dated. They're still fresh. And I think I showed Back to the Future 1 not too long ago to my 6-year-old nephew, and he absolutely loved it. It's one of those things where I think it's never going to lose its magic, especially for first time viewers being like, oh wow, this is incredible.
And just a few years ago, the DeLorean time machine from Part 3 was going up to auction, and Desi and his co-owner, who owned it at the time before it going to the Shays up in Massachusetts, who bought it. They invited me down to where it was being shown at the Esprit de Concourse in Pebble Beach in Monterey, California. And it was there that I first, they wanted me to be with the car as a celebrity from the film to help promote it and get some publicity, which turned out, I guess, to help because it did auction off successfully a month or two later. But it was there at that exhibition that the Blu-ray had just come out and someone popped it on and was showing it. And it was like watching a new film for me. I had the depth and clarity was astounding, and as well as the sound and everything. It was just amazing. It was like seeing it for the first time again in Blu-ray.
No, yeah, because when the I think it was the 20th anniversary DVDs came out, I got that set. I watched all the special features. It was like watching, because I remember having to go down to Blockbuster to rent the actual tapes, which is such an antiquated statement now that I'm thinking about it. But I had to go rent the VHSs, and I would watch those over and over again. Then the DVDs, and now the Blu-rays, they just look incredible. Hopefully one day we'll get them on 4K, and that way we have a whole new experience with the film's franchise. Now,
and that's where the studio will make more money again. You know, 4K really is astounding. Once you see 4K, it's like, wow, I can't believe I thought HD was the end. Now 4K is really astounding, isn't it?
It's just going to keep going and going. You know, we're not going to be, I'm not as good as a future predictor as Robert Zemeckis might have been back in the day. But before I let you go here, because we're closing in on the end of our discussion about this film, a few questions. First of all, out of all the characters in the movies, I have a feeling we already touched on this, but out of all the characters in the movies, excluding the character of George McFly, of course, who is your favorite character in the trilogies?
Oh boy, you know, I of course adored Doc Brown. You know, so much fun and quirkiness. And I love what Leah did with Lorraine. And Marty, of course, you know, that's a tough question. There is also, you know, some of the other minor characters that are fun too. That you got me there. You know, Don Fogelov had so much fun doing his character, and Harry, of course, as Marvin, even the, Griff's gang. I really enjoyed hanging out with Darlene and company. I liked hanging out with Flea.
Well, that must have been cool. I'm a huge Red Hot Chili Peppers fan. I'm a little jealous you got to hang out with Flea.
Oh, we'll talk. I got some recordings you might like. We'll do some training. I also have I had a good time hanging out with Billy Zane. We spent several hours together listening to music and chatting. And you know, even though he was minor in part two, the Biff's gang had some fun quirkiness. You know, J.J. Cohen was a sweetie. I didn't work with J.J. on the films, but rather met him at some of the cast reunion stuff, and we become friends. So it's you got me on that one. I'd have to probably come back to, it's kind of a tie between Doc, Marty, Lorraine, and Biff. You know, Tom was a sweetheart to work with too.
Yeah, really, I'm sure Biff was. You know, I think his acting in that series is really underrated. I really do, because he really embodied that Biff character, and even Old Man Biff and Griff and Mad Dog Tannen. I mean, he really had a real, showed his range, you know, in a variety of situations and characters. And I really think, retrospectively looking, I think his acting might be underrated on how great he was, especially as the alternate 1985 Biff, which is my favorite one out of all.
And it really came out. I was given some screen tests to study when I was cast. And in those screen tests, Tom and Crispin and Leah are all having a blast. And you see Tom in one shot, I think it's a makeup test, and Tom just comes up with the line. He goes, "McFly, what is that, an Irish bug?" And it's really great because he's just so in the character so deeply, and it's just very natural and fun. And they, of course, they had the luxury of rehearsals for many weeks and then shooting with Eric Stoltz for almost 8 weeks. So by the time they got to Michael and working with him, and company, you know, they were pretty polished. They had it pretty nailed down.
Do you think that was difficult? You know, as an actor, you're getting used. You're going through shooting and rehearsing with an actor for almost 2 months. And then out of nowhere, well, not out of nowhere, but they pull him from the project and hire a brand new actor. Do you think that was a challenge for the people on set, especially Christopher Lloyd?
Well, yes and no. I mean, for some of the actors, example, you'll hear in interviews Tom talk about, you know, being called in to the producer's office and thinking that they were being fired when they were being told that Eric was being let go and that Michael was coming on board, and finally breathing a sigh of relief. Oh, God, thank God it's not me, but oh, shoot, I feel terrible for Eric. You know, yes, it's a challenge in that there's the emotional stakes and the emotional price that's been paid, especially if you know, support that actor. I met Eric. He's a nice guy. In fact, we both tested the same day for the lead in War Games that Matthew Broderick got again. But
that damn Matthew Broderick.
Well, anyway, everyone gets, I guess, what they need to get. So the thing about working, you know, when you have, you know, well, first of all, on most films, you don't have the luxury of any rehearsal time except for maybe a day on the set before, or a little time on the set while they're lighting. It seems like most films and TV shows now, you get cast in on Friday and you're ready to rock on Monday morning, you know. But obviously the Back to the Future film, the first one, they had the luxury of being able to rehearse during makeup tests. And then there were screen tests, of course, for different roles. And that's all considered rehearsal time. And then I'm sure there were script meetings and such. But having that is really a great luxury for an actor. Otherwise, you're kind of left on your own to your own devices, which can be often a mistake if you're not given, say, a lot of background and information on relationships. You have to make that stuff up. And if you get to the set and find out that you're in the wrong ballpark, you have to start over or just start from fresh. So, yeah, having rehearsal is great. If you had worked with someone for many months or weeks, and then all of a sudden you have to switch gear and adapt to a new actor, I don't think that is a huge obstacle. Generally, it's just listening and chemically getting in tune again with that person's rhythms, or trying to find the comedy or whatever you're building in the scene.
Yeah, no, wow. I never even thought about it like that. To me, I would think that you develop this relationship and chemistry with somebody, and then boom, you got a new person in. It'd probably be a little weird, but yeah, that makes sense. You know, I guess it's almost like stage acting, is you have the understudy there, and you know, if say the understudy has to come in and take over, you can't miss a beat. You got to have the same chemistry. So I guess it's a similar situation. We are here, 2015, the year that Back to the Future 2 was set in. I am talking to Jeffrey Wiseman, who played George McFly. Yes, that Irish bug, George McFly. I thought I told you to never come in here again, McFly. But there's so many things going on.
In part two and part three,
yes. But there are so many great things this year. You know, I've gotten to talk to my friends Cassim Gaines and Jason Aaron about their projects. Jason's doing an awesome documentary, which I think you're a part of, Back in Time. Is that correct?
I got to meet them at the DeLorean Owners Convention in Dayton, Ohio last year, and they expressed interest in coming out to interview me on the West Coast, and I got them introduced to Kerner Optical, which is now 3210 studios down in San Rafael, which used to be, Kerner was the model shop for Lucasfilm for many years, and they shot a lot of the special effects scenes at that shop, and they didn't know about it. So we actually shot my interview for their film in the Lucas Theater there at Kerner Studios. And I also introduced them to my friend Mike Smith, who was on the special effects team there, who spent a whole month doing the miniature of the locomotive in part three going over the cliff and blowing up.
Wow, that's incredible. Oh, man. That was probably a fun job, too, to get to put that together. So there's so many great things, so many projects coming out about Back to the Future, and I want you to support them all, but definitely support this Back to the Future cruise to end Parkinson's. Like I said, something very near and dear to me. Jeffrey, I thank you so much for doing this cruise, and I'm going to help out in more ways than just talking about it. I want to be about it. Where can people find you on social media?
Thank you, Brad. I have a fan page on Facebook, Jeffrey Weissman, and that's Weissman. I have my page, which, of course, I've been so busy I haven't updated. It does need updating, but jeffreyweissman.com. You can see all the different projects and characters that I've done in my career. And you know, I also teach and consult and all sorts of stuff. My personal page, of course, has been at the 5,000 friend limit that Facebook has for several years, so that's not really a great idea to try to friend me there. But you can, I think, follow me. And I post pretty constantly on the fan page on Facebook. And then I'm on Twitter at Jeff Weissman. And I think that's about it.
Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for coming on the show. We'll talk again in the future.
What a great pleasure, Brad. And I hope that we get to meet and hope to see you on the cruise. And remember, folks, bttfcruise.com. Book now. We have a $50 discount that we've just extended till mid-May. And the cabins are being swept up, so best to jump on it.
Yes, get the jump on it. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Brad.
So there the man was, Jeffrey Weissman, here on the Brad Gilmore Show On Demand. I thought it was a very interesting interview. And if you enjoyed this interview and you enjoy Back to the Future as much as I do, don't forget I have Back to the Future, the podcast. We're in season two. We're about 4 or 5 episodes in. Finally, we is an actual thing. I have two co-hosts, like I said, David G. Mitchell and Norman Binford and Brad Gilmore, some very professional-sounding folks. Over at Back to the Future, the podcast, season two, you can get it at backtothefuturepod.com, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, or follow us on Twitter at BTTF, the podcast, or on Facebook at Back to the Future, the podcast. Like us, find out all great new things that we're doing over there. We have some interesting episodes coming up this week. Actually, we're doing a thing that we already did called Good Cut, Bad Cut, where we look at scenes that were cut out of the movie, and then we talk about, was this a good cut? Was it a bad cut? Should they have left this in? Was it good that they took it out? Was it unnecessary? What was the point of the scene? And we kind of break it down like that, which we already did for part one of the Back to the Future trilogy. We're doing it for 2 and 3 here this week, upcoming week, on Back to the Future, the podcast. And we actually get into one scene in particular that's really, really polarizing between the three of us. A couple of us agree on it, a couple of us disagree on this particular scene from Back to the Future Part 2. And I think, well, I'm not going to tell you what I think right now, but I'm going to say it's sparked a lot of conversation, and I think it's one of those things that we could look back on, you know, 2020 being hindsight, and say, ooh, that was a very interesting scene. So you're going to have to tune in and see what I actually think about it. But I have some great stuff coming up here on the Brad Gilmore Show On Demand. We're going to be back full force. I want to remind you to always subscribe to the show. Give us a 5-star rating. Also, check out Back to the Future, the podcast, in season two. Check out my 3/5-day-a-week show that I do with my broadcast partner from Reality Wrestling, Matt Topolsky, called Your Opinion Doesn't Matter. And that's not your opinion, the audience. That's his opinion, Matt Topolsky, because his opinion doesn't matter. We talk pop culture, sports, wrestling, the whole nine yards. So go check that out at opinionpodcast.com and use the hashtag YODM on Twitter, and you can find us that way as well. I'll be remiss if I say to not check out Heated Conversations with Booker T, whom I co-host with every Saturday night on Sports Radio 610. That's 610 a.m. here in Houston, Texas. And I think that you will find that show to be interesting. This upcoming week, this Saturday night, we have the Ayatollah of Rock and Rolla, Chris Jericho, will actually be on the show. So we talked to Chris about his career, talk is Jericho, his books, his band, and also a funny story that he shares that Chris, Booker, and I all shared at the Night of Champions pay-per-view backstage. A very funny incident, very entertaining incident that Chris Jericho recounts like only Chris Jericho can, with the utmost hilarity. So check all of those shows out, and check me out every Sunday morning here in Houston on CW 39 for Reality of Wrestling. I'm sitting ringside. I got the best seat in the house, aside from you at home watching from TV. So I'll check you out next time here on the Brad Gilmore Show on demand.
Oh, Brad, what have you done now?